Heather McDonald has got the juicy scoop. When you're on the road, when you're on the go, Juicy Scoop is the show to know. She talks Hollywood tales, her real life Mr. Segment, Serial Data, and Serial Sister. You'll be addicted and addicted fast to the number one tabloid real life podcast. Listen in, listen up. Woo, woo. Heather McDonald. Juicy Scoop.
Hello and welcome to Juicy Scoop. We have a lot to cover, lots of updates, and then I have an expert who has been covering the Ghislaine, is how she says the English pronounce it, Maxwell trial, which she really helps explain what's going on, and it's absolutely riveting. We cover so much in general about this topic. So that's coming up in a little bit, but let me just cover a couple things. This just came out today. I mentioned that there is a documentary, I believe it's on Amazon, about the Playboy Mansion. And Holly Madison just did an interview where she talked about her first traumatic night with Hugh Hefner. And since I just had Kendra, I read the article and I thought I'd share it with you. So she said that she, you know, when I maybe was introduced to the Playboy world, and she went on her first date with Hugh, and she went there to ask if she could move in to the mansion and be one of the girlfriends. This is when he had like seven or so girlfriends, right around 2000. It's when I remember I got the invitation to the New Year's Eve party. This is the one where then I called and RSVP'd with my husband and never got invited again. But it was he and his seven blonde girlfriends. So this was before Girls Next Door. And she knew that you'd have sex with him. Of course, she knew that was part of it. But she says, but I really wanted to move into the mansion and experience that life of being a playmate that lives in the mansion. And after the evening, she went up to the room. And she kind of thought that she'd just be observing or really decide what's going to happen. She didn't know what was going to happen on the first night. She said he was pushed on her, I assume by other people, because we now know that it was a lot of group sex type of activities where I believe he was always the only man, but several girls would hop on, hop off. I mean, there's a lot into it. So, afterwards, she said it was very traumatic. She couldn't believe that everybody just watched it happen and didn't say or do anything about it. But then she felt like, well, I came here to move in. I've already had this awful thing happen to me. I'm okay with it continuing, I guess. But rather than just go home with a traumatic memory, I might as well just get what I came for. So I said, well, can I move in now? And he said, yes. And then they went on to date and, you know, if you watch the show, she very much wanted to marry him. And anyway, it's just very interesting how these things happen and kind of in having Kendra's interview recently. I just find it all really fascinating. I believe both of their experiences, and I find the honesty like pretty riveting and not surprising at this point. I feel like everyone now in 2021 is like, all right, let me just be honest with what I was thinking, which is why I always say I am waiting for that actress to come out and say, yes, I did sexual things with Harvey Weinstein because I knew that was the only way that I could get the part. But once I got the part and proved to the world I was a really talented actress, I never had to do anything that I didn't want to again because now I was legit actress, but I knew I would never be seen or make it or have that opportunity to show the world I was good unless I played this game. And I was like, you know what? I can suffer for 20 minutes and be disgusted if it means I can be a Hollywood actress. You know that these women exist, and I'm begging you to come out and tell your story on Juicy Scoop or even another podcast. I don't know why you would, because I'm at the top of the charts as a female. Thank you. I also talked about this article that I remembered my mother reading me from the LA Times in 1998. And thank you, everyone, who sent me the LA Times article. But they also, Daniel sent me this one from Entertainment Weekly, which was really even a little more concise. So the woman was 32 and she was pretending to be a 19-year-old writer. And her story was, and coincidentally, Entertainment Weekly had put out that she was one of the young stars to watch in entertainment. So she was put on one of those lists. And she came out here after she graduated from high school in 1984, and she was very little. She was like 4'11", 93 pounds, and she was always trying to get these acting roles, so she always presented herself as younger, and she wasn't doing great in acting. So then one day she's like, I'm just going to sit down, and she wrote this pilot called The Two Sisters, and it was about two high school sisters. Somehow it got to UTA, United Talent Agency, which is a big agency out here. And they were like, oh, my God, this is amazing. And because she was presenting herself as a 18-year-old actress at the time, even though she was like 31, 32, she also did that with the writing. So then they bring her in and they're like, this is amazing. You're this like protege genius, this young girl that can write so well. This is exactly what we want. We're going to put you under our agency. They throw her on Felicity, which if you remember that show, it was about a girl in college. So they're like, this is perfect. We actually have a person that knows how to write, that's only 18 years old, that can really do great on the writing staff. Felicity threw her 19th birthday party when she was in fact 32. She wore like baggy clothes. She talked about how hard it is to be a high school person. She pretended to have a crush on Jonathan Taylor Thomas, or someone like that, that was like, I don't know, some kid on a TV show. Amazing. So once they found out, and I find it really interesting how she lied, because when you get a real job and you're in Writers Guild and stuff, you got to show your paperwork to get paid, to get insurance. So that's kind of, I don't know how she got past that. I don't know if she actually like secured a fake Social Security card. But I think that's why more people have not gone this route, because it's kind of genius. It's all about youth. And of course, actors have lied about their age in the past. I remember Rebel Wilson actually sued a tabloid and won because they outed her, saying that she had lied about her age when she had never lied, but people assumed she was younger because she was in these pitch perfect movies. And she's like, them putting out the fact that I, in fact, lied made me, you know, lose jobs, and she won. So I think it's really hard to, like, really lie. I haven't heard of anybody successfully doing it. So my next quest to the Juicy Scoopers is, can you find me this girl? Her name is Riley. Oh, do I have it written down here? Hold on. Okay, I wrote it down before. Anyway, it's the 19-year-old, quote-unquote, Felicity Rider. Her name is Riley. I would die to talk to her. I would die to interview her. I really want to know where her life went, because she had a huge deal with Disney worth $500,000 to create new shows, to, you know, come up with new concepts. And at all the writings that I found about this article at the time, they said, we don't know if Disney is going to go forward with their commitment. I'm sure they didn't. I'm sure they got rid of her. I'm sure UTA dropped her, all from the thing of, you weren't honest about your age. But that kind of sucks, because if the writing was really good, I find the whole thing fascinating. Then someone else sent me this movie that came out about 5 years ago. It was like a Sundance film. Which, by the way, you guys, I'm going to Sundance, and I am not getting a huge influx of invites, okay? It's therealheatherintal@gmail.com, okay? I think you want me at your events. Anyway, it's a story of this guy, J.T. LeRoy. Anyway, what this movie is about is a female writer who appears to be like in her 40s, started writing these books as this person named J.T. LeRoy, who was a young boy who was the product of a prostitute and a truck driver who lived a very poor life, who was sex trafficked, and wrote all these books that were very popular that people wanted to put into movies and everything. And then everybody wanted to meet J.T. LeRoy. So the 40-year-old female writer had a young friend who was female, and she threw a blonde wig on her and made her dress like a boy, and that J.T. LeRoy went out to parties and stuff, and Winona Ryder thanked him, quote-unquote him, at an event. And so this isn't the first time people have taken on a different persona as a writer, but I think what made the story about the Felicity Rider interesting is that it wasn't someone writing books as, you know, you don't know if it's a boy or a man or a woman writing it. She was presenting herself in meetings, in production meetings, pretending that she's turning 19, all of it on a set in a writer's room every day. I mean, imagine like the references and everything to go, oh my God, yeah, like I remember because I was, you know, 10 when that happened, and then like keeping up with the math and all of that when you know you're 13 years older than what you're pretending to be. Fascinating, fascinating.
She's in Hallmark movies now.
Who is in Hallmark movies?
Riley Weston.
Okay, so Annie said Riley Weston, who is the writer, is still working as an actress in Hallmark movies. Okay, well, then it's your job, Annie, to go find her and get her on my show.
She lives in New York.
She lives in New York. We can do a Zoom. We figured out how to do that. also, a juicy scooper told me, I have some juicy scoop. In case you talk about the new Peloton commercial, which I did, where we find out, you know, quote unquote, Big is alive. He left with his Peloton instructor. Jess King is married to the woman, Sophia Arista, who peed on the man on stage. So this person actually is a real Peloton instructor, and she's been following Jess King on IG for years, and that's how she found out she's married to the woman who peed on the guy on stage. These Juicy Scoop stories just really make full circle. I talked about going to the Ben Affleck movie. I did not realize that J-Lo walked the red carpet. I don't know if she sat in the movie theater. I doubt it. But she did walk the red carpet. She kind of wore her classic look. You know, neither of them are smiling in the photo, but that's just because that's they know that's how they look the best. Anyway, this didn't help me. You know, I've always loved Ben Affleck. Well, he's losing it for me a little. He went on Howard Stern. And now his words can be taken out of context, but from all the articles I've written, I think it was pretty clear what he said. Maybe it wasn't his intentions, but his words were, I would still be drinking today if I was still married to Jennifer Garner. Okay, that's not very nice. He said, I stayed in the marriage because I felt trapped because of my kids. And because I felt so trapped, I had a bottle of scotch every night and passed out on the couch, which wasn't good. I wanted to be a good dad. So that's why I stayed in this marriage to Jennifer Garner when I wasn't happy drinking my booze. I have to tell you, I tested for a talk show with Jennifer Garner, where she was going to be on like once a week and I was going to be on all the time. And tested means like it's the final thing. It's like you do your contract. You're basically you're going to get it until they call you and they say you didn't. Anyway, it was talking about like sex with your spouse, whatever. And at the time, she was married to Ben Affleck, you know, and you know how horny I got for Ben Affleck in The Town. Not in every movie, not horny for him in the tender bar, which I just saw. That did not get me horny. He's smoking too much. And I didn't like his hair or wig or whatever that was. It's on Amazon Prime. Anyway, she said, oh, you know, the other night, we both woke up at 3 a.m. and went to the bathroom and we're like, well, better now than never. And we had sex. And I'm just like, are we supposed to pretend that you're not married to Ben Affleck? Like, I'm now imagining Ben Affleck at you at 3 a.m. in your Pacific Palisades home, just like boning in like the rising sunlight. Like, stop. Okay. And I'm trying to get this job. Anyway, there's also a scene of them like on a street corner. It looks like maybe they're doing pickup or something for the kid. And he's got a mask on and like a nice trench coat. And he's like just, you know, you can tell he's just kind of yelling through the mask, like about whatever, some kid situation. And I was just like, you know what, Jennifer Garner, I know you're thinking, you know what? You do you, boo. You and J-Lo, go have him. Go have him. Enjoy the cigarettes. Go have him. Go let him blame you for shit. I mean, I drove you through a drive-thru at Jack in a Box before I took you to rehab. Okay? How is it my fault that you ended up in rehab at all? But you want to tell Howard Stern that? Go ahead. What a miserable life being married to me as I raised your three kids. Okay? Thank God I have a Chase credit card. All right. Get that? Because she works for Chase. Okay. Well, Caitlyn Jenner wasn't too pleased yesterday or the day before. Caitlyn put on her stories at Beverly Hills Hotel. Fuck your horrible service for not letting me have lunch with this tiny rip in my jeans. Shame on you. disgusting. I've been a patron for decades, no longer at Dorchester Collection. Dorchester Collection who owns the Beverly Hills Hotel along with a lot of other places. Ripped jeans is a weird thing, okay? I've been to a country club, and one of the weird strict rules that they have, which if I ever bring a girlfriend, I have to tell them because you wouldn't think it, you cannot wear ripped jeans. And most guys don't have ripped jeans, but girls have skinny $300 ripped jeans that are super stylish and you're wearing with a little booty and like, you know, you're dressed to the nines, whatever, they won't let you. And they put it in their guidelines at the Beverly Hills Hotel. They're like, no casual hats, no sleeveless shirts for men, no ripped jeans. So anyway, Caitlin was pissed, and Caitlin belongs to Sherwood Forest Country Club too, and I'm sure that's the rule as well. And just so you know, you guys, just be careful of where you wear those ripped jeans. Are ripped jeans even in anymore? I don't know. I never was into it. But also, I talked with Brandy and Julie about the Irish goodbye. Irish goodbye means you go to a party and you don't say goodbye to anybody. Well, I got this article sent, and they said they did a study in Australia of people, and the people that do the Irish goodbye and just leave without saying the goodbyes saved 2 days a year in their life. If they're invited to 25 parties, they figured out that it takes about 45 minutes from the moment you decide, I'm going, I want to leave now, to the moment like you get in your car to go home. It takes about 45 minutes. You have to repeat yourself. You have to say the story to everybody of why you're going. The person goes, no, stay. So in this holiday time, I say do the Irish goodbye. I agree with what the study says. The host doesn't remember. The host is focusing on the other people. She or he is already buzzed or whatever. And then once you realize your guest has left, like I did, I was like, oh, well, you missed out on the photo. But like, I wasn't hurt. Like, I get it. Sometimes people get a little drunk, tired. They just go. Anyway, you can save 2 days of your life. I watched Sister Wives, and something kind of juicy happened. Guess what they're talking about, you guys? Coyote Pass. They still have not decided where their homes are on Coyote Pass. And so Mary, who I just showed, Mary, she was the first wife. I have this photo of them when they were young. And then this is Janelle. She is the second wife. And Janelle says to Mary, I'm concerned that you want your house by the pond. By the way, this pond is the saddest looking thing. They just basically dug out some dirt and stuck some water on there. And they're like, she's like, I'm afraid if you're near the pond, you're going to have a problem with all the kids coming near your property to be on the pond. Because when we lived in the first house, like I guess right when the show started, you didn't want us walking through your apartment for Janelle to go to Christine, wife number three's place. The only place way to go besides going outside of their units was to walk through Mary's living room. And Mary's like, I'm sorry. Like, I worked two jobs. I only had one kid. You guys each had like five or six. I didn't want you traipsing through my living room. It doesn't mean I'm going to be pissed if someone comes near the pond. Anyway, everyone is unhappy with Cody. Nobody wants to be married to him. But Mary's like, I don't care that he does. You know, she has a lot of people watching this and they're like, girl, Mary, he's not interested in you. Like, he doesn't want nothing to do with you. And she goes, I know that, but this is where I want to spend the rest of my life. I don't want to try to find somebody else. I like Christine and Janelle and Mary enough that I really don't want to leave. And so I just kind of thought that was interesting how they like, and then he's saying like, you know, polygamy, the only way to make polygamy work is if we all act like saints. And these ladies aren't acting like saints. You know, and am I the head of the family or not? Like with his hair flying everywhere. I mean, I cannot talk about Coyote Pass anymore. As you guys know, Christine, wife number three, is now out of the picture. Someone said they saw Robin and Cody out shopping at a mall. They asked for a photo, and he said 6 feet away because he's very, very COVID afraid still. And I don't know, you guys, you don't need to watch the show. I will tell you, they are getting, they are starting to put some water line in, finally after 2 years, so that people can enjoy the most disgusting, ugly pond you've ever seen in your life. Okay, now I'm going to get into the Ghislaine Maxwell trial. I've always found this whole thing to be really confusing. We get into the real juice of it with someone who's been covering it, and you will love her. Also, you guys, what you will love is going to see me live. I'm going to be at the Tempe Improv February 4th at 7 p.m. and then two shows on February 5th. Listen, you can buy these tickets right now and make it a Christmas gift. If you don't live in the area, you know what's gorgeous? In February, Phoenix, Scottsdale, Tempe, it's all right there. Make a girl's weekend out of it. Present your girlfriends with a gift. Plan your fun for 2022. This right now is the only date I have for 2022. So I'm letting you guys know well in advance because it will sell out. It has in every year that I've performed there. So get your tickets. It's a great gift. Also a great gift is Patreon. A lot of people are asking for Patreon for Christmas from their husbands or their moms or whatever. You could get it. I have so much juicy, juicy scoop that I'm going to be sharing this Friday. You want to listen to that. And there you go. You go to heathermcdonald.net for tickets and for Patreon. And now let's meet our guest who is going to share everything on this pretty intense topic. This is a trigger warning. This is about child abuse and sex trafficking and the trial and how billionaires really have abused the system and how they get away with it. So get ready. Hello and welcome to Juicy Scoop. I have an expert who has been and is following by the minute the Ghislaine Maxwell trial. And there really is just so much that I've tried to recap and share it with you guys on the show. And I just decided to dedicate a little more time today to get everyone up to speed. I have someone I found on TikTok. Her name is Shannon Ivy. Welcome, Shannon.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Yes, from San Antonio, Texas. And when I started to see some of the stuff that you did, I also really love that not only have you found an interest in covering this in a really great, in-depth, but still concise way through your TikTok and Instagram, but that you have gotten involved in this because of what you do on your farm, which is helping kids who have been sexually abused and traumatized. And why don't you just tell everybody a little bit about what you do? Because I think it sounds amazing.
Well, my husband and I, about 10 years ago, started advocating for kids. It actually started in LA, down in Santa Monica, where there's this huge population of young people who hang out down there on 3rd Street Promenade. And we started volunteering down there. And then long story short, we moved to Texas and we started doing the same work here, volunteering for, child abuse really in the foster system. And when we got down here, the immigrant problem and the sex trafficking problem along the I-10 corridor was so massive that the need was so great that we started working even more hours. And he and I we're not social workers. I have a degree in journalism and art. I mean, we actually were in LA because we're filmmakers. And then we came down here and I'm working at a university and he and I had already had our oldest son and we decided that it was time that we were going to adopt out of the system. We did that and Governor Abbott am I allowed to cuss on this?
Sure.
Oh, yes. Governor Abbott was a complete piece of shit, and he took away all of the disability services for kids with any kind of disability, including mental illness. So when we adopted our kids out, we went from having, therapy appointments in between, any kind of medication or whatever, to just medication appointments. And when you're dealing with little kids, that's not okay. And so we took our kids out to my dad's farm one day and they were just better. And so we decided right then and there that we were going to kind of save up all of our money and buy a farm. And we did. And we started having victims of sex trafficking, of child abuse, and of the immigrant population, because we have a huge immigrant population down here. The, you know, just the kids who had traveled for months at a time and then came here, didn't know the language, didn't know the people, and they would just come out here and just be kids. And so really, that's how, in a nutshell, that's how we got started in this. And I really started the TikTok during quarantine because my students, I teach media. And so my students, they were scared to produce content. And I was like, all right, fuck it. I'll do it. You know, I'll put some stuff out there. Never in a million years did I think anybody would care about, because it's not a good concept. I mean, we're talking about child abuse and farming, you know, it's just, it's not. And it's terrible. Then all of a sudden, because I was pissed about what was happening in Texas, the video started going viral. And then skip to the Ghislaine Maxwell case. I saw very quickly that they were going to ignore it. And
they being mainstream media.
Yeah. Yes. And while they'll write it just to cover their ass, I mean, if you Google it, you're going to find, you know, Reuters and AP and NPR, they do stories on them. But the first 3 days, it was very simple. It was very simple storytelling. And I was pissed because I knew honestly, we have to clean up the mess of what this does to children. And we've been cleaning up the mess of what this does to children for the last decade. And I was sitting there and finally I was like, you know what? Fuck it. I've got a journalism degree. I'm going to start putting stories together. And I did. And then within the first day, it just, and I was like, all right. So people are interested in hearing about this from the perspective of somebody who's been doing this for 10 years, I guess. I don't know. I honestly don't know why. why people are listening. I really don't.
Well, I mean, it's exactly why I was intrigued to talk to you, because I'm like, this isn't someone that's just regurgitating stories. She's not only telling it and letting us know. I always call it, you know, news that's been squashed, like squashed stories. And I had it happen to myself. When I had something happen, I did a long interview about it and it never came out. And I called the person and I go, what happened in my interview? Oh, my editor doesn't feel it's relevant anymore. I found it later. The person whose story was about is very, very powerful. And they picked up the phone and made sure, or they hired $1 million media PR company to make sure that these stories didn't get out. And the only people that knew about the story are the people that were listening to my Juicy Scoop podcast. Literally, like, no stories were written about it. And, you know, and I know people write stories because I'll get a Google alert that I interviewed a Real Housewife and she said this on my show. So I know all these people are listening. I know my numbers. And it was just and I was revealing this entire juicy story about my previous owner of the podcast company that I was at 5 years ago. And it was before Me Too, and nothing was getting about it. And that's the first time I realized. And then when we found out through Ronan Farrow and everything he did with Weinstein and everything, how this has been happening for years. And then of course, with Epstein and the first round of trial that he went to and everything. So I love that you're doing it. And I love that you are a genuine person that's not just like, oh, I'm doing this because it's juicy and I'm the only one doing it. Like, you're really out there to help children. And my sister is also an attorney for reunification of families and, you know, children and sometimes the parents, and it's rough, you know? And so I sometimes hear what she goes through in representing sometimes either side, you know, she has to do what's best, and it's just really hard. So I appreciate what you're doing. And I love that these kids are responding so well to just being out in nature with the animals and everything. I think that's amazing.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I mean, I hate talking about my kids at all, but of course, I mean, you're a mom too. And so it's hard to like not talk about your kids. But I mean, this last year, I'm sure you know what a traumaversary is. You know, it's when something really terrible happens to somebody. And then it seems like that time of year is when triggers start to happen, night terrors, panic attacks, things like that. And after being on the farm, this was the first year that one of our kiddos had nothing on their traumaversary. Like it came and went, it went. I mean, and in years past, we've ended up in, you know, in hospitals and such. And this year was the first year. And so I don't have any science on it. You know, like I know that there is science on it. I just know that it works. And, you know, we might as well, if we have it and we've been blessed with it, we're going to give it away. And I feel like that's kind of the same thing that's happening with Ghislaine Maxwell, is that there's a lot of very academic approaches to looking at this trial, you know, but they're not actually looking at it from the kid's perspective or from the abused perspective. And I think that there's so many people out there, particularly women, who have been abused, who've been traumatized, who have been touched inappropriately, that I think that those four victims connected with abuse victims all over the world. And I honestly think that that's why there's this underground movement to know more about the story.
Okay, so let's get into it. What day are we on of this trial? And then let's cover all the big juicy things that have happened so far.
So we're on, well, it's weird because we should be on like day 13, but we're not, because we took a 3-day break. And we just found out like now why we took a 3-day break. And it's because Judge Nathan was confirmed today to be the second circuit court judge of appeals. So that is a federal position that was appointed by Biden. And that happened today. And she was Senate confirmed like an hour ago. Like I saw a picture of it like an hour ago. And so that's why we took a break, which I find fascinating. And I don't want to pour into conspiracy theories, but it is suspect, you know, it's weird.
And why is it suspect that the fact that now she's Court of Appeals and she's covering this? Explain why people find it suspect.
Well, because none of the names are being released. So there are hundreds of pages of call logs. I believe the last number I heard in Ghislaine Maxwell's Black Book was 2,000 names. And Judge Nathan has repeatedly said, I don't want to do any unnecessary name dropping. And so the question is, why not? Because these are not people. And, you know, of course, the lawyers are saying, well, it's because they're not on trial. And it's, you know, it's not for the public good, which I call bullshit on that. Because if you have an elected official making decisions for the masses, and that person is in cahoots with somebody like Epstein and Maxwell, then yeah, it is for the public good that we know who it is and we don't vote for them. We do have power and we don't vote for them, but we have to know in order to make that decision. And them quashing that, just like you, them not letting us know, I think is very suspect.
Yeah, definitely. So one of the things I saw, like, a special or whatever, after they had arrested Maxwell, and her brother was speaking, and they were saying, you know, that she's in these horrible conditions in the prison, which I believe they sound horrible. I don't think prison's ever fun, but they, because of who she was, the flight risk, the people she knew, they were going to keep her in this prison until the trial. And one of the thoughts was, is the prosecution trying to get her to break, to share these other powerful names? But what is your thought on that?
So I've sat through a lot of court. And so I'm looking at the conversations that she's having with her brother right before the jury walks in. And I can't help but think that she is in solitary confinement all day and she's considering, hey, you know what? I want you to go talk to this person or talk to that person. And then little things start to come out, right? And it, I hate to go into any conspiracy theories of like what I think, because at the end of the day, we have to just deal with what we know and what we're being given. So yeah. My whole channel will blow up. with having nothing but a bunch of conspiracy theorists, if I give any oxygen whatsoever to a possibility, because then they're going to be like, Shannon said, and I don't know that I want to postulate. I think that she, could they try to get her to break? Yeah. I don't think she is. There was one time that I was in court with a, and I was there advocating for children who had been very, very badly abused. And I saw the father in court and I'm standing there and he's just staring at me. And so I said, hi, I'm Shannon. I want to let you know that they're okay. You know, and because at the end of the day, this person's a human who's probably been in the cycle of abuse. And maybe they'll learn something. I don't know. And he chest butts me and says, I know who you are. And I was like, all right. And I just kept real cool. Well, he proceeded to just stare at me. All the time, just stare at me.
Wait, so exactly. What was he on trial for?
Child abuse.
Oh, okay. And he was denying that he was guilty?
Well, this is kind of my point. It was about control.
Oh.
I don't even think he cared about being guilty. And I see that in Ghislaine Maxwell. I see her behavior of staring at the artist who is creating renderings of her. I see that in her staring down the witnesses. I see it in her staring at the jury. There's so much control that honestly, I don't see that she is just so fragile that she's about to break. I think that she's very calculated because I've seen it before. It's not like they've done anything new. It is so textbook grooming and human trafficking. It's almost comical how unremarkable it is.
Let's talk a little bit about the grooming. One of the TikToks I saw that you did where you said, oh, I noticed there was this moment where there was a judgment on something and Maxwell seemed very excited about it. And then you realized it was because the art, the photos of their weird art, I assume, was that only the weird art at the Epstein townhome in New York wasn't going to be allowed. Let's talk about that.
Apparently prosecution had a really great day that day because they had one of a key witness and a key victim come out and speak. It was a very compelling testimony. And then at the end, I see this one line saying Ghislaine Maxwell seemed really excited and she was hugging on her attorneys. And I started thinking about it. I was like, she won something. Again, I've been in enough court to know that if prosecution truly won, they wouldn't have been hugging and they wouldn't have been showing any joy whatsoever. So I started just digging and I think I found it in like an Irish paper. I mean, because the Irish, by the way, hates Prince Andrew and it's comical the way that they cover this trial. And I think that's where I found it, in like Dublin. And it was this one line that was like, and, you know, Judge Nathan did give a little bit to the defense by, you know, not letting prosecution admit the art of the paintings of the naked children because it was excessive. And right then and there, I knew. I knew that that was the thing that they won. Because part of the grooming process, a huge part of the grooming process when you have kids is porn. And the fact that they had naked, like scantily clad in compromising positions, paintings of young girls, literally all over every single estate. It's part of the grooming process. They were disarming the children as they were walking through. And the fact that Judge Nathan did not allow that to be seen, allow that emotional response, that guttural feeling of, oh my God, this is the art that they bought. This is what they consumed. This is what they chose to get a fucking hammer and nail and put it up on their wall. And they said no. And so to me, that was a huge win because now the jury has zero picture as to what their kink actually was.
Well, I know that in that big article that was written, and even articles that were produced. So there was that big article that was supposed to be about the two sisters years ago that were going to tell their horrible story of being groomed and molested and trafficked and everything from Epstein before he went to prison in Miami, right?
Yep.
And then they squashed that. But there have been articles where people write flattering about Epstein, where they do say there's some strange art and they describe some art. So to someone who studied it, we know that there's been weird art. We know that when there was a dinner party at his house in 2008 with a lot of celebrities that happened to be invited, and I'm not saying these people are guilty of being there, but you know, Woody Allen and Sun Yi and Katie Couric and Chelsea Handler, they were all there. I mean, I remember after being at Chelsea Lately, Chelsea telling us, you know, oh, I sat next to Woody Allen, you know, because I got invited to this dinner. And I can see why people just don't know the history and they go to a fabulous party while they're in New York because Katie Couric invites them, you know. Right. So I'm not saying everybody that's taken a photo with Harvey Weinstein at an awards thing is guilty of anything. You know what I mean? Right. I've been at a party where someone's wanted to take a picture with me and I'm like, oh, fuck. I don't know if I want to get a picture with that person. Yeah. Like, what am I supposed to do? You know? So I think there's an element of that where I don't like the pointing at every single person that's ever been in a room with these people, but it was again about the weird art. And when you say that is a grooming process for pedophilia, such a common story of boys that have been molested by Catholic priests is that they would go over to the priest's house and they would plow them with alcohol and weed, and they were teenage boys, and they'd watch heterosexual porn. And then they'd say, well, don't tell anyone, you know, because you'll be in, your parents will be furious that you had pot and alcohol and watched porn. And then when the priest then molest them, if they were to tell their parents about the priest, then they also are like, have that fear that, well, my parents are going to get mad about that. And then I remember even with like Corey Feldman talking about Michael Jackson, he had said there was a book out, an anatomy book, but it was full genitalia and stuff when he went to go visit Michael Jackson. And so very much normalizing it to the child that this is normal and this is what normal people do. This is what people do when they like each other. This is not a big deal. All of that. Even if you're a 14, 15-year-old girl and you kind of know not, I do think it just starts to get in your brain. And then, of course, the power and everything of being in this situation and feeling terrible about it.
I mean, in our world, it's called manipulation to form attachment. And in the next step after that is the attachment to control. And then finally the control to acceptance. And so it's just, it's part of the cycle of saying, okay, I'm going to manipulate you into forming an attachment with me. I mean, if you listen to Virginia Robert Jeffrey's stories,
she's the one who was with them for many years, who, her claim is that she went to the nightclub with Prince Andrew with Ghislaine and then went back to Ghislaine's place, had to take a bath with him and have sex with him. And Ghislaine said, do for Prince Andrew what you do for Jeffrey. She was 17. There's a photo of them together. Prince Andrew has denied it over and over again. Said it absolutely just didn't happen. I guess he thinks that photo has been photoshopped or something, but it's clearly her apartment. Ghislaine's in it. Talk a little bit about what, sorry to interrupt. I just want to get our people up to speed.
So I don't remember what point we were making.
We're saying about Virginia, that what she was trying to say about the manipulation and the acceptance and all of that.
Oh, the way that she was describing their relationship, she kept describing their relationship as a family, which is so indicative of children who've been abused or trafficked. I mean, one of the constant questions that is in every single one of my threads is, well, where are the parents? Well, most of the parents were in either active addiction, they were dead, they were missing, they were dirt poor. And people are like, how could they do this for $300? Well, I mean, that's a tremendous amount of privilege to say something like that, because clearly you've never had to choose between rent and food. And that's the type of poverty that we're dealing with. And that's point number one of the grooming process is finding your mark or finding your victim. And the way that Ghislaine Maxwell found her victims was so textbook. And so when we're looking at this entire thing, things like the art absolutely matter. And I just don't think that the prosecution, because God bless them, they're like, what, 20 years younger than Ghislaine Maxwell's team. I mean, and I'm not trying to be ageist or anything, but that's just 20 more years in a courtroom where you know how to manipulate the room, you know how to manipulate testimony, and they're going on the offensive and they're brutal about it. I hope that because the jury is a jury of New Yorkers, I hope that the handbook that is so ridiculous, I hope that that they are common enough people that they're going to look at all of this and go, of course she's guilty.
I think what I find confusing, and I want to clarify for the world. So there were these girls that were like literally in junior high that lived outside of Palm Beach. And, you know, one met somebody through Epstein, started to come over, would do the sexual massages, you know, and full rape, everything for money. They then recruited their other friends who were, like you said, poor homes, not two parents. If there were, they probably both were addicted, really on their own from like 14 on. All of that is what originally got Epstein in trouble. They did do a trial and testimony, and then he got this ridiculously small sentence. Because why? Because the girls were teenagers? Why did that happen?
Okay, so first of all, one of the confusing things is that the age of consent is different for each state. And even in Paris, the age of consent was 15. And so the stuff that they did to Kate wasn't technically illegal because the age of consent was so young. I believe at the time of Epstein, the age of consent in New Mexico was 16 years old.
Oh, that's where, that's where he had the big estate where he would get people to, he would talk about how he's going to do all this like DNA science engineering for MIT and get these people. He would donate all this money and everything. And then he had this like sick situation going on at that fancy ranch out in New Mexico with all these girls being subjected to torture.
Yeah. And everybody thinks that everything happened only on the island, and it didn't. And a lot of the, like Trump, he had gone back and forth domestically. A lot of people aren't looking at the fact that he owned it. Donald Trump owned an entire airline at the time that he hopped on Epstein's plane. He didn't need the ride. You know, I mean, he literally owned a fleet of airlines or a fleet of aircrafts. One of the things I find interesting about the period, though, when he got off, number one, it was the local people who said, all right, I've had enough. Vanity Fair, the New York Police Department and the FBI all knew about Annie and Maria Farmer well before anything happened in Palm Beach.
Those are the two sisters that shared their story. What year?
Right. Right. In 2002. And then in 2003, Vanity Fair hears and they said, hey, you know what? Do the story on this socialite Epstein. So she goes out. She does. And one of her sources says, he's a pedophile. I've got somebody, you need to talk to them. And so the entire story shifts. She goes and she interviews them. She thinks she has this great story. And then Epstein shows up at Vanity Fair before it even opens in Graydon Carter's office and threatens him. And then the head of a dead cat ends up on his porch. And so Graydon, yeah.
Yep. So then Graydon kills the story.
Kills the story. But here's the messed up part. That fucker, and I have zero respect for him, because that fucker then goes in 2017 and he was just so scared that he had to kill a story that ended up hurting so many girls. He's pictured with Ghislaine Maxwell at the Vanity Fair Oscar party. But he was just so scared that he could not run a story about two young girls. And it just, it, like, every time I think of that, it infuriates me. Because, I mean, you know, Graydon Carter was the it guy. I mean, he's the guy everybody, he had a restaurant, for God's sakes, that only, you know, a certain level of people could get into. It's just disgusting. And he, that decision that he made hurt countless kids.
So,
countless.
Okay. So, like, let's do a little timeline. Okay. So the article gets killed. Then it comes out about all the young girls just outside of Palm Beach in the poor areas. He gets this, he'd go for 8 hours a day on a weekend or something to Miami. Mm-hmm. He gets out. He starts rebuilding, not even rebuilding. People come to the parties, come to the dinner parties. He's donating all this money to like MIT and acting like he's like this scientist or whatever. So that's like 2009-10.
Well, go back to 2006, though, because Alexander Acosta is the one who the Palm Beach Police Department did an amazing job giving them everything that they needed to put him behind bars, everything. There were four journalists out of Palm Beach that were just nailing Epstein. And Acosta goes, and not only does he say, 13 months in prison, but he gives him immunity, which is now what Prince Andrew today is saying, hey, go look at that trial. There's immunity. Like there's like, we need to pull all of that stuff up. I'm not guilty. There was a bunch of stuff that came out today about Prince Andrew, and I haven't done a ton of research on it, so I don't want to talk too much about it, but yeah. I mean, so when you're looking at, and then Trump putting Andrew Acosta or Alexander, is it Alexander Acosta, into his cabinet, you know, and so you see these little pieces of how he got away with it. And at the local level, those are the only people who had the balls to stand up to him. A police officer that was making probably what it costs to have toilet paper replenished in all of his estates, you know? And it was those people who stood up to him. And it's those people who broke this thing wide open. People who made nothing.
So, okay. So after that, he goes and has his dinner parties and has his life. He's still hanging out with Ghislaine all the time. What crimes happened after he got out, and are those part of this trial? This is where I get confused.
No, they are only doing 10 years. I think it's, they're only doing 90. God, it was the late 90s to the early 2000s. They're not even talking about anything beyond that. So the Clinton years, you know, he was shown to Epstein after all of that happened, or during, I guess, went to the White House 17 different times.
Epstein did? So,
yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
17 times.
Of course, Ghislaine was present at Hillary, at Chelsea Clinton's wedding. We know that.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And what about the photo that resurfaced that surfaced between Ghislaine and Epstein were at the Queen's cabin? What year was that?
You know what? I don't know. I don't know off the top of my head. And what about the one where Ghislaine Maxwell and Kevin Spacey were sitting on the throne?
The actual throne?
The actual throne. They were sitting next to each other on the throne.
Have you seen the video that's going around with the naked boy coming out of Buckingham Palace?
Yeah.
What is your thought? So there's a video and people are saying, people have said, this is fake, this isn't real, but it was someone filming like the soldiers going by, you know, Buckingham Palace. And you see a naked boy on a rope coming out of Buckingham Palace. And then he drops to his death probably. And what is your thought on that video?
That all of these people do not look at human beings as being valuable, and they're making decisions for us. And that is a terrifying thought. The fact that Epstein was gifted two children his birthday.
Wait, what's that story? Tell us that story.
Yeah. Jeffrey Epstein, and I forget who gifted, it might have been Prince Andrew, gifted two young girls, was gifted two young girls for his birthday. He had his way with them and then sent them back to France the next day.
Is that part of this trial?
Oh, no. Like, none of these stories are part of the trial because I talked to a judge yesterday, and he was telling me that it felt like the prosecution is trying to really streamline, like, here are the things that she's guilty of, and we're going to prove without a shadow of a doubt that she's guilty of these things. It's a yes, it's a yes, it's a yes, and just keep it super tight. The problem with that is that when I think about the defense coming in with 35 witnesses, I don't know. I hope that her attorneys don't mop these younger attorneys up. That's what I think. I mean, they're smart. I mean, one of her attorneys defended Osama bin Laden's like right-hand man. And so these are people who know what they're doing that cost a lot of money. And so I'm afraid.
In a nutshell, what is their defense? That she was just his friend, that she was just at social parties? Like, what is their defense that would convince a jury not to give her any time? In a nutshell.
For the victims poking holes in all of their story and going on the offense, very aggressive offense. And then they're trying to say that she wasn't, they're not going for a victim. I saw it really concisely put in The Independent earlier today. And it was that the girls are being paid off and that this is a memory manipulation. Oh, that drives me nuts. So there's this woman she's a psychologist out of UC Irvine, where I went to graduate school, and it like hurts my soul that she is a professor. She has testified against the witnesses and against the victims in the Jeffrey Dahmer trial and Harvey Weinstein, Jerry Sandusky, some of the most heinous child abuse cases on record. And this woman has gone there and said, you know what? Memory's a funny thing with trauma. You're not really going to remember what you think you're going to remember. And she pokes holes by having studied this her entire life in saying that these girls don't remember. And, look, they're in active addiction. There's no way they're going to remember everything. And to that, I say, fuck you. They're probably having night terrors every single night about a very specific point within their trauma.
Do they reference the McMartin trial in that? Ever. Do you know the McMartin trial? That was the preschool out of Manhattan Beach in the 80s, that it was kind of like a crazy like witch hunt, where they said all these kids were being molested at the preschool by the family that owned the preschool. And in the end, they showed the videos of the people talking. These kids are young. These are not women, or even young girls. These kids are like 4 and 5, and they'd be like, so you weren't touched here? And they'd say no, and they go, but all your friends said that they were. Are you sure you weren't? And it was like this really bad way of coaxing someone. And with that, I think it was so crazy, because I remember reading about it, my mom, and we believed the whole thing. And then when it was, these people were totally cleared and there was no proof that this ever happened, I think when you do hear someone now poking holes in that, if you're familiar with that, you kind of go, well, could that have happened? I mean, I don't believe it did in this case, obviously. But because there is the McMartin trial, I think sometimes people do give that theory a little more weight than they would have had that not existed.
Well, the markers of evidence have grown since then. So for kids that little, things like going number one and number two in their pants, and that would be a marker and for a really long period of time, because that's something that would ward off a predator. And so experts now look at different things other than just what is communicated by a child, and so particularly that young. And thank God for them, because they do, the burden of proof it's very difficult to slap a child abuse charge for someone that young, because they are so young. And so there's some amazing people who gather evidence, and the markers are different now.
Interesting. God. That's good. So, yeah. Getting back to all of that. So it's basically just that these people were paid off, that she was not part of it, or is it that she was part of it, but all these people are lying? That they were just willing participants and they were of age.
Well, not all of them were of age. And I mean, I don't know how old your kids are, but I saw that you had kids and
teenagers. Like,
right. I mean, how wise is a 14-year-old? How wise is a 16-year-old? How wise is a 17-year-old? Particularly those who have been that young. And it, you know, what I find interesting is that, yes, we're talking about child abuse, but, you know, prostitution is still illegal in those states. And so even if we're just talking prostitution, the transaction of money, and no one's talking about that. Everybody's just going, okay, it's child abuse. And I'm sitting back going, well, you know, at the time that was still illegal. Doesn't matter what you feel about, you know, sex work. It's just it was against the law and, you know, that's something to go after. I have so many questions just about how some of these things have been handled and why they've given certain, why they've charged her with certain things. I mean, you know, about the Mann Act, right?
No, tell us that.
Okay, so a couple of her charges are with the Mann Act. So that's a federal offense to take a person across state lines for the purposes of sex. This goes back to slavery. They're like, hey, you can't take people that you own across state lines and make them do things. Thank God, that's smart. And so that's why the pilot is such a big deal, because that is something that all of them are guilty of, which is why, again, their names need to be released. Because if you have adults on the plane, like Prince Andrew, like Bill Clinton, like Donald Trump, knowing that this victim is on the plane and you're crossing state lines, then all of the adults there are guilty. All of the adults know that that child is going to New Mexico to have sex with them. And so why aren't we talking about that? Why aren't more people on, you know, being indicted? This is the big question. And I think money is at the end of it.
Yeah, absolutely. We've all wondered, you know, how did Epstein become so incredibly wealthy? I think that he had these powerful people with him. I think they had sex with the young girls that he had there. And then I think the next day he was like, I have proof that you're, you know, having sex or getting a blowjob from a 15-year-old girl. Invest in my company, give me $2 million, whatever. That's my theory, because I just don't understand how he became so wealthy. What is your theory?
Les Wexner. I think that's where it started. I think he started by conning his way into managing money. I mean, the guy barely had an education and ended up teaching college because he conned his way in. He's a classic narcissist who thought so highly of himself that his confidence, people bought into it. And I'm sure he was charming. And I think he got into the fold of Les Wexner, who owned Victoria's Secret, and he was able to use, hey, you know what? I know the guy who owns Victoria's Secret, you want to come? And so many girls said yes, because they wanted to be in the circle of Victoria's Secret, right?
Right.
And so I think that that's where he got a big chunk of his money. But then I agree with you. I think because, oh my God, the hard drives and the DVD, that whole story just drives me crazy.
What is that story?
So he has this big treasure trove. It's widely known within the Epstein circle that he had an inordinate amount of security cameras. They're everywhere, right? And he's recording everything that everybody does, including in the bedrooms, in the bathrooms, everywhere. And he's got this treasure trove of software, of hardware, of DVDs, of all of it. And so NYPD goes and gets a warrant to open the safe, where this thing is. Well, they open the safe, but Epstein's lawyers go, well, you don't have a warrant to take the stuff inside. And so they were like, you're right. And they left the stuff that was in the safe on top of the safe, left, went and got the warrant. When they came back, it was gone.
Ugh. So frustrating. Like, oh my God.
It's like, it's so stupid. And that's the thing that drives me nuts is that they actually think that people are just, that everybody's just so stupid that we're like, oh, that wasn't planned. You know, I mean.
And who is this weird, who is this guy that Ghislaine married and was like living in some country house when she was found and arrested? What is that all about? Do you know anything about that?
Well, see, there's no proof of that. And so the only proof that we've got is a little bit of, you know, hearsay from the ex-wife, who, by the way, I feel so sorry for.
The ex-wife had her current husband, you mean?
Well, of her alleged current husband. There's really nothing, you know, there's two guys that they said she could be married to. But
how can you not find that out? There's either a marriage license or there isn't.
I think it goes back to money. I guess they just live in a different world than we do. And the entire justice system seems to function in a different way for these fuckbags. And forgive my language, but it's just like, it's frustrating because at the end of it, I know that every single one of those girls who is on that stand, who took that stand, went home and probably crumbled into their hotel rooms. They probably had night terrors, maybe still having night terrors, re-traumatized from that trial. And I mean, you probably know this, it is a long road to recovery after something like that. And these people, you know, sell two people or give two people as gifts or, you know, throw them off of the top of a, you know, ceiling as a party favor. It's like, these are human fucking beings. And these people don't have any, they don't have any regard for human life at all. And, you know, this is made abundantly clear by the fact that Ghislaine Maxwell had this multi-million-dollar, you know, conservation 501c3 that had millions and millions and millions of donations, right? And then you see her house manual and, you know, she throws away toothpaste after half of it is gone. And if a third of a Kleenex box is used, she throws the rest away. But yet, you know, she's looking at the commoners and saying, reuse, reduce, and recycle. But fuck you, I'm going to throw away toothpaste after using it 8 times. So it's just a different world for them.
And I think it's just so interesting that she is a female, she is on trial for this. And that's another thing that we've become more and more aware of is how complacent women are in pedophilia, how oftentimes they are active participants in it. You hear about people that have been kidnapped and the wife or, you know, the female companion is the one that why the person felt comfortable going in the car with them because there was a baby and a woman. So they're like, oh, this family can give me a ride. And then they're like their sex slave for, you know, living like the girl in a box. That was the story of the girl in a box story, is that she was kidnapped by a man and a woman with a baby in the car. And she thought she was just hitchhiking. And so this is just a much wealthier version of that.
Yeah. And the dangerous part about this is that it's going to set a precedent for everything that's underneath it. Because if the demand is not exposed, then that's going to embolden all of the people who are on like the south side of Houston right now, trafficking, you know, young girls in seedy motels, because really that's what trafficking looks like in the real world, is people trafficking for a WIC card or rent or food. Women and children, you can buy a WIC card is how you buy, you know, food or it's a government subsidy.
Right.
That's what human trafficking looks like in the real world. It's why the Atlantic piece pissed me off so bad, is because it's like, oh, it's fake. And they went and they sought out every single possible, conspiracy theorist around human trafficking. I did not talk to a single person who actually works in human trafficking. So
So wait, that Atlanta thing. So was that story true or not? Which was they found? What was the Atlanta story first?
So The Atlantic, that is owned, that publication is owned by Lauren Powell Jobs. Yeah. So they sent this poor writer who probably didn't know out to find every conspiracy theorist on the face of the planet about human trafficking with all the QAnon stuff. And she found them and she did a whole story and said, oh, you know, America's great, in parentheses, fake human trafficking epidemic. And then she proceeds to tell us all in long form journalism how fake this human trafficking thing is. Well, everybody who works in the human trafficking world read that article and was like, no, the conspiracy theorists are fake. What you didn't put down there is that we are prosecuting victims of human trafficking as prostitutes. And so the numbers are skewed. There's so many. I did a video on it because after I read it, I was like, this woman didn't even remotely do research on human trafficking, particularly not at the commoner level, I guess. And then there is a, you know, it's like you can't make this shit up. There's a picture of Ghislaine Maxwell and Lauren Powell Jobs, who owns The Atlantic, sitting poolside, you know, in bathing suits, like laughing and giggling. And that comes up. It's like, you can't make this shit up. Can't make it up.
Yeah. Shocking that she would write that story or have that story in her paper. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, you just, and people are like, why do people have conspiracy theories? Well, right there, you know, there's a picture who's released of you like hanging out with Ghislaine in her bikini, giggling away, and you say that human trafficking is fake during the Ghislaine Maxwell trial in a fairly well-respected publication. You know, I mean, The Atlantic does good work. And that was just, it was so insulting to everybody who works in this line of work. So insulting.
Right. I mean, I can't imagine what it's like when I think about the officers that have to look at the child porn to put a case together. And what they have to go through, you know, what their life is like.
So I've known two. And I've been wanting to do a video about this, particularly because of the Duggars. So I've known two human beings who looked at child porn for evidence. And the theory is that they're only supposed to do it for 6 months at a time. And then they rotate onto something different. And they're getting care the whole time. Well, one died by suicide. And the other one is so far gone in PTSD that every aspect of their life has been hurt because of it. And so, yeah, you're right. There are so many people on the ground who have to put these trials together, like the child porn stuff. And people like The Atlantic didn't talk to any of them. They didn't talk to an immigration officer. Immigration officers see human trafficking every single day. Not one person was interviewed from immigration or Child Protective Services, who fights it every single day. And it's just like, you know, it's again, these aren't their kids. Like, it's not rich kids who are getting trafficked. It's poor kids. It's broken kids. It's kids of color. And so, yeah, why would they actually tell the truth or do an article on it? You know? They're going to say, oh, those stupid hicks that are coming up with conspiracy theories. And yes, they're ridiculous, but why not tell the real story of like what's going on?
So what are the good things that the prosecution, that are points for the prosecution that has happened so far in the trial?
You know, I think one of the most compelling arguments, honestly, was, I think it was Caroline. So all of these women are now middle-aged, right? And so they've learned some things. And I believe it was Carolyn who came in there and she was broken, you know? And everybody who was there said that her testimony moved the jury. And I think that the jury had to look at somebody who admittedly said she's on methadone. She's on, you know, because she's had an addiction for a long time. She's on a high level of Xanax because she's having to get through what happened to her. And that's what we see. Like, we see that profile.
And what was her story of abuse with Epstein?
This is so messed up. That the very first night that, so she came from a mother who was, had active addiction, and her mother allowed her grandfather to molest her starting at age 4. So she was brought in. I don't think that her, you know, pyramid higher up was revealed that day. But so she goes in and she's told that she has to go give a massage to an old guy, and that she's going to get a couple $100 for it.
So and she how, goes and how old is she at that time?
14. Mm-hmm. And this is, I believe, in Florida. And she goes in there, she starts massaging him. He's on his back and he starts to ask her. And so does Ghislaine Maxwell, starts to ask her about her abuse when she was 4 years old, like asks her about it. And so she's telling the story of being abused by her grandfather at 4 years old. He turns over, is turned on by that. And then he has like sexual or asks for sexual acts during that. It's horrific. Ugh. I mean, when I read that, because this is his thing, right? I mean, of course he gets off on it. And I think one of the most shocking things, everyone said that the jury kind of gasped, is she said that she ran away with this boyfriend who also testified. And she came back and she was 18 years old. And when she went to him, because she needed money, and she went to him and he looked at her and he was like, "Do you have any younger friends?" And she said, "It was then that I knew that I was too old for him." And the jury all went, oh. And so that's what I think the prosecution has done right, which is, this is why the pictures were so important. They led the jury into having an emotional connection and an emotional response to the victims. And if any single one of them in there has an emotional response, that's going to be a win for the prosecution. I mean, you know this. I mean, you're in the arts. Stories are so much more valuable than a mere statistic, right? And so I think that they've told story well. I mean, that's the nonprofit that we started in Texas that got us into all this in the first place. It's called Theater for Change, because we were going to these things for child abuse and people were handing out pamphlets. And we're sitting there and we're watching nothing happening, no legislation, no nothing. And so then we were like, wait a minute, we just need to put a camera on them and tell these stories. And we did. And then all of a sudden things started to happen. I think it's the same thing. That prosecution went in there and they looked at all of these girls and they said, okay, we got to tell story. And they did. And that's where they were successful. And then after seeing that, the defense had the gall and the sheer arrogance to sit there and go, are you sure you remember everything? Aren't you a meth head? I mean, aren't you a junkie? You know, and after having something, you know, someone bare their soul and break down, they come at her with the force of, you know, I don't know how they.
Well, it's like in the documentary Leaving Neverland, and there's just photographic proof of Michael Jackson's companions out in public, mm-hmm. how. After the boy would get to a certain age, there'd be another boy that would be out with him for a couple years at all the events and Disneyland and red carpets. And then there'd be another boy. Yep. And the victims talked about that all of a sudden he blew them off. He wasn't yep. interested in them once they became 16 or 15.
I've heard a lot of people refer to that as growing out of their lust or growing out of their kink. And I think that that's a very apt description, because there's something that goes dark. I had this happen to me when I was a kid. I was groomed by a youth minister and I remember it very specifically. I came home from college and I looked at him and it's like he didn't even recognize me. And I was like, oh, and I've had the exact same moment of looking at someone who's groomed and that you've just aged out of their lust. And I think that that's what happened. And the jury got to hear that. So I think that that was successful.
Yeah. So, how much more do you have any idea how many more days this trial might be and what in fact she is looking at?
So I've read a couple of different places that they want to be done by Christmas, like before the Christmas holiday. I have no idea. And here's the thing about having done this for the last 10 years, it's really hard to predict what's going to happen on any given day in court. And it's really hard to predict whether or not something's going to come out because, I mean, it's just, it's kind of like the way that the entire thing started. They were supposed to open with Jane's testimony and Jane was victim number one, but because the jury selection took so long, and I think that this is where the age of Ghislaine Maxwell's attorneys are coming in. They took a long time, you know, completing the jury selection. And so they just had like a half day. And so had they started Jane on that half day, her testimony would have been cut off, which wouldn't have been as effective. So they had to start out with the pilot, and the pilot got up there, and P.S. he totally would have been, indicted for, you know, against the Mann Act as well, because he flew them over state lines. Right. And so he confirmed for the defense that, oh, I didn't see anything on those planes. Oh yeah. They were boyfriend and girlfriend, but I didn't see anything. Yeah. They were young, but they weren't, you know, they weren't underage. And so that's how the entire thing started. So I it's really hard to predict what it is that they're going to do. These people are really good at their jobs. And, you know, I mean, everybody's saying that, you know, Comey's daughter, James Comey, who really loved Clinton, she's on prosecution. And people are saying, oh, that's why she's not letting the book go, you know, the little black book go forward, because she's friends with, you know, her father was friends with Bill Clinton.
Yeah. That's not great.
Oh, what a tangled web.
Oh, my God. Well, I thoroughly enjoyed talking to you so much. And there was just, and there, some of your TikToks are just amazing. And one that stuck with me was when you said, when you would get the foster children and you'd go to the store and you'd say, you can pick out some toys. And there was, just tell the rest of the story.
Well, so we were placed with a child 2 weeks before Christmas and beat up head to toe. I mean, black and blue everywhere, and which is another story. And we figured out we had to go get Christmas presents for them. And so I go to Target and I'm like, all right, have at it in the toy section, thinking it was going to be this exciting thing. And instead he starts kind of walking around. And so I just followed them, and they stop at the lamp section and just pick up a lamp and hand it to me. And I said, well, I just kind of came down. I was like, baby, I'll buy you a lamp. You can have a toy too. Well, what do you need a lamp for? And they just looked at me and they said, so I can see him coming. And, you know, he's talking about the person who hurt him. And then my mother reminded me after she saw that TikTok, and she said, you do remember Christmas, right? And I was like, oh yeah. And what happened on Christmas is we thought that, of course, like waking up and it's going to be super exciting because there are all of these things. And they came downstairs and they just cried. They saw all of the opening of the presents and they just cried. They had never seen that.
The two kids after the layoff.
No, just the one. I'm using just the one. Because I'm using a gender non-specific.
Okay.
It's their story, right?
Okay. Right. Okay.
And they came downstairs and they just bawled, just cried, because it was too much. They had never been given that many things. They didn't even really know what toys were. I mean, it took 4 or 5 years to just take that kid to a playground and where they were free enough to just get on a slide. Instead, they had their head on a swivel, making sure that they weren't going to get hurt. I mean, this is what I'm talking about cleaning up the mess of all of this. There are, you know, tens of thousands of people across the United States, across the world, who take the kids that are on these victims. And we're seeing that every day, where a 2.5-year-old can't go to a playground to play because some piece of shit decided that, you know, they were going to ruin that child's life because they couldn't keep their dick in their pants. And forgive me for being crude, but it's disgusting. This is what I will say though, we're getting better at finding them. And so if anybody is doing this, who's listening, the technology is amazing. And I know people who are working in InfoSec who you think your VPN is covering you. It's not. And that's real precious. And
I don't even know what them. I don't know what you're talking about, but I guess people would know what you're talking about.
They will. Okay. And they're gonna, it's a way to cover yourself on the internet.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And we're getting better at finding you and putting you away. As long as you're not, I guess, a billionaire, because then you just have a different justice system than we do, I guess. Hopefully not, though.
Well, I love what you're doing. I know. Thanks. I know my audience is going to be really compelled to do everything they can to fight this and, you know, say something, see something, all of it. And they can follow you, Shannon. Tell everyone where they can follow you.
At Ivy Family Farms. And that's all. And it's Ivey Family and then Farms with an S, even though we don't have more than one, but I would like to.
Maybe one day. I think there's going to be a lot of people compelled to hopefully follow your model or help you grow your model. So thank you so much. And I will be checking in as more stuff happens for sure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for spending time on your show to talk about this. I cannot tell you how meaningful and important that is for everyone who works in this world. So thank you for taking time to do that, because that's incredible.
Now I'm going to cry.
I'm sorry. But that's pretty big.
Thank you, because, you know, it's not my normal show. You know, I am a comedian, but I love having this show because if I feel like I want to talk about something, I'm going to talk about it. And some people might not want to listen, but the majority of my audience is really thirsty for the truth. And so I just knew that when I saw you, I'm like, she is doing some really good work. And I just really appreciate your bravery.
Well, so are you. I mean, you're being brave enough to actually put people and talk about it on your show. I listen to the other ones and it takes bravery to do that where you're at too. And so you're in the fight too. And so thank you for doing that. I mean, really,